You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hey, has anybody noticed this crazy thing that we're on the road to socialism?
What I believe is that there's certain things we've got to do.
This is a lurch towards socialism.
And we've got to help people who are having a tough time. They don't have health care.
One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people.
Mrs. Clinton tried to do this a number of years ago.
Has been by way of medicine.
Lately, he's called me a socialist.
Is it socialism?
It wasn't under me that we started buying a whole bunch of shares of banks.
Here we go from $1 trillion bailout.
Socialism.
To $1 trillion health care.
Socialism.
To $1 trillion stimulus.
Socialism.
You're going,
but
I'm taking from the rich. I'm Robin Hood Obama.
By the end of the week, he'll be accusing me of being a secret communist because I shared my toys in kindergarten.
This is a lurch towards socialism.
I shared my peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Socialism.
Since we've been hearing an awful lot about socialism recently, we thought it might be a good idea to learn what it really is. So on today's edition of Please Explain, we're going to look at the origins and history of socialism, its current economic model, and how it came to be such a loaded term in this country. Joining me now are Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, and James Surowiecki, financial columnist for The New Yorker magazine, and I'm very pleased to welcome them back to our show. Hello.
Hi.
And a reminder that we also take listener calls during these Please Explain segments. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Eric, isn't socialism a very broad term? What is the most basic general definition of it?
Yeah, well, there are probably as many definitions of socialism as there are socialists. Probably a smaller number of people call themselves socialists nowadays than in the past, but you know, I think the easiest way to think about socialism is that it is a large, it's an umbrella under which a number of ideas have, gathered over the years, inspired by a desire to try to find a better way of organizing society than capitalism. In other words, to try to get away from the inequality of capitalism, the greed and selfishness and self-centeredness that a market society seems to inculcate. And, to try to think of ways of organizing an economy and a society to promote the public good rather than private self-interest. Now, that's pretty vague because there have been many, many ways that people have tried to go about doing that. Sometimes it's by sort of correcting the abuses of capitalism, but still basically having a private market economy, as in, let's say, Scandinavia. Sometimes it goes the whole opposite direction, as in Soviet Russia, where all, you know, the major features of the economy are controlled by the state, etc. But in the American tradition, where socialism has and was in the past a significant presence at various times, socialism has been always very democratic. In other words, it's there was a great socialist party before World War I, it has not been this sort of dictatorial or violent concept, but it's been trying to figure out a way to remedy what appear to socialists to be the evils of capitalist society.
Where does Karl Marx fit in
all of this? You know, Marx once said socialism originated in America, which we may not quite realize. The earliest efforts to do what I just described were actually communitarian settlements, little communities established before the American Civil War, New Harmony, Oneida. Some of them were religious communities where people tried to live without private property and in a collective, communal, cooperative way. And they thought that by creating a better society within the existing one, you could sort of peacefully and easily eventually inspire a transition to a socialist society. Marx, writing in the mid-19th century, transformed socialism into a theory of revolution. His writing said, you know, capitalism will create a impoverished working class which eventually will rise up and overthrow the rulers of society, and the means of production, the basic economic structure of the society, would be controlled by the community. But it would come about not peacefully or gradually, but through this violent revolution. So Marx's theory of capitalism probably has influenced almost every socialist of one kind or another to think that, you know, that, in other words, his critique of capitalism. But after Marx, many socialists did not adopt his revolutionary attitude. And in Western Europe, for example, and in the U.S., in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, you got these large socialist parties which were purely parliamentarian and electoral, and they wanted to come to power by democratic means. So Marx is there as the great theorist of socialism, but not necessarily as the one who laid down the practice that all socialists wanted to follow.
So anybody can say he's a Marxist and represent something quite different. James, is socialism incompatible with capitalism and the free market?
Well, I think yes. I mean, I think if you want to say socialism as opposed to social democracy, which is I think what Professor Foner talked about when he talked about, you know, Scandinavia. I mean,
those are mixed economies.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the U.S., all developed countries at this point have mixed economies of one sort or another. The state plays a major. There is no developed country in which the state does not play a major role. The closest thing, probably, to one that was a kind of pure capitalist state would have been Hong Kong before China took it over. But what we're really talking about, for the most part, in the West and Japan, are figuring out what the right balance is between the state and the market. But socialism per se, I think, insofar as it does, for me at least, historically, has implied some measure of major ownership of the means of production by the state, it is incompatible with the notion that the market actually is the best way to organize economic activity. And, you know, we can argue about, the argument could be about whether or not that's because capitalism is freer for individuals, or the more common argument nowadays is just that capitalism is more productive, that you actually just get better economic results with it. But you know, I do think socialism is fundamentally, you know, its origins are, as Professor Foner said, in an antagonism toward the things that capitalism brings, at least by some accounts, to society. And also, I think, a kind of rejection of the notion, which is really at the core in some ways of capitalism dating back to Adam Smith, although I guess it's a little complicated, the notion that relying on people's private interests, on their greed, to actually produce kind of the common good is either sketchy in the sense of the idea that that can work seems kind of strange, or alternatively that there's just something kind of ethically or morally dubious about it.
Now, in that little clip we heard, some people accused Barack Obama of being a socialist because he talked about seeking a more equitable distribution of wealth and power line. But is that one of the goals of socialism?
Well, of course it is. This was great for me because last term I was teaching a course on the history of radicalism in America. And, you know, I said I never really thought that socialism would become an issue in the presidential campaign of 2008. It seemed rather arcane. But in fact, we had been talking about Eugene Debs and the Socialist Party before World War I, and I think my students knew a little better than John McCain and Sarah Palin what socialism was and wasn't. But I think the point that we just made is also critical. You know, socialism on one level is an economic theory. It's a critique of a market society. On the other hand, it's also a kind of ethical impulse. And in fact, most people are attracted to socialism over the years, not because of a particular analysis of the economy, but because of a moral distaste for some of the features of capitalism. You know, Marx in the Communist Manifesto and many of his writings praised capitalism enormously for its ability to create wealth. Socialism was never supposed to be the mode of accumulation. The problem with capitalism is, and this we face even today, capitalism is unrivaled as a way of generating wealth, but it's terrible as a way of distributing wealth. So you get vast inequalities, which is why, as we heard, every society, of course the U.S. is way behind on this compared to most civilized places, but every society has a safety net and has progressive income tax. We don't really have that, but most other societies do, where there is an attempt by the government to redistribute, to protect those at the bottom in a market society, and to try to redistribute some of the wealth that capitalism has created. Because if you don't do that, you're going to end up, you know, where we were in the last few years, with all the benefits of economic growth going to a tiny segment of the population.
The topic on today's Please Explain is socialism. My guests are Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, and James Surowiecki, the financial columnist for The New Yorker. If you want to join the conversation in a little while, our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Because of that redistribution of wealth, haven't many European labor unions identified themselves as socialist organizations?
Over the years, they have. I don't know that they do anymore, necessarily, but, you know, the British Trade Unions League adopted back in the late 19th century this kind of vague call for collective ownership of the means of production. Many unions in the past have been very connected to socialist movements, but I think that certainly is no longer the case, either in the United States or Western Europe. You know, there's another whole part of the history of socialism which further complicates matters, which is that after World War II, socialism for a time became very important in in anti-colonial movements in countries that were becoming independent, former colonies, whether it was India or Vietnam or countries in Africa, some of them, felt that somehow liberating themselves from the control of the world market was part of national independence, and they adopted various kinds of what might have been considered socialist economic policies. None of them seemed to work very well.
And almost all of them have abandoned
pretty much
the concept.
Yeah. Well, yeah, even the ones that claim still to be communist, like China or Vietnam, are actually operating pretty much as market economies now.
James, much of the criticism of the New Deal and more recent economic proposals was based on concerns about introducing more socialism into this country. How much socialism is already a part of our economic system?
Do you say how much socialism?
Yes. We don't have as much as perhaps the Western European countries, which maintain it even when they have conservative governments. But
yeah, I guess, I mean, I think I would put it differently. I mean, I think that the socialist label, and this is certainly the case with the attacks on Obama, is one that has routinely been used by the right. I'm not even saying this critically, this is just simply objectively true, has routinely been used by the right to attack pretty much any form of constructing a safety net or having the state be involved to one degree or another in important decisions like healthcare. Certainly, if you go back to the debate, for instance, one of the classic examples would be the debate over Medicare in the 60s. In a sense, I'm not quite convinced that it's actually that useful to think of social democracy or safety nets or as socialist exactly. I mean, they clearly date back in some respects to the kind of ethical impulses that drove the socialist movement in the 1800s. And one of the famous things that you'll hear sometimes from both the left and the right is if you go to the Communist Manifesto, many of the things that Marx called for in that and that seemed at the time quite radical have over the years become they seem quite normal, even in the United States. A progressive income tax of some form. I can't remember if minimum wages, but there are trade unions and the like.
Weren't many of them instituted initially in Germany, for example, by von Bismarck, who was a conservative, as a way of co-opting the arguments of people on the left.
Right. I think it is. You know, the fact is, as was just said, socialism has become a toxic, to use a modern phrase, word in our political discourse, sort of like liberal was for a bit. Nobody will call themselves a socialist in mainstream politics, even when, as we said, they are advocating ideas that socialists may have pioneered in one way or another. And if on the other hand, Republicans use this just to tar anything that they don't like with this brush of socialism. I think the actual, a turning point in this was right after World War II when President Truman proposed something we haven't quite managed to get to yet, which is national health insurance. And the American Medical Association and others launched a giant campaign, which eventually defeated it, calling it socialized medicine. That term.
Dwight D. Eisenhower was concerned about creeping socialism.
Right. So the term socialist, if you can attach it to something successfully, it will pretty much kill its political prospects. And of course, that comes out of the Cold War. And also, another thing we haven't mentioned, we could go on for hours about all this, you know, the Russian Revolution, I think, really was the turning point in the history of socialism. Before World War One, as I said, most socialist parties were parliamentary democratic parties, but the Russian Revolution put into power a very different kind of socialism, not only, you know, taking over all the means of production, but totally undemocratic, tyrannical, eventually, and based on this notion of a tiny cadre, you know, a leading party undemocratically ruling a state. And that, so socialism through, even though many socialists in the world did not identify themselves with the Soviet Union, socialism came to be associated with this highly undemocratic system that existed, you know, in the Soviet Union, and made it very difficult for democratic socialists to maintain the sort of their own identity.
James?
Well, I mean, to some end, that obviously that issue was also compounded by the fact that, with the possible exception of Allende in Chile and maybe Arbenz in Guatemala in the 50s, there were no, the 20th century doesn't really have any examples of socialist states that were genuinely democratic. And you know, it's an interesting question about the difficulty of, can you have the state control most of the means of production? In other words, control people's jobs, control the press to some extent, control how capital is allocated. In other words, if the state owns most of the banks, the challenge of then having democracy becomes, you can see why that would be complicated. On the other hand, it's also complicated when a small group of people in a capitalist society exert most of the power and are able to dominate the government as well. But I do think that when socialism became real, in the sense of became established in states, it did. I think that's right to say that the debate changed.
Well, has there ever been a case of a pure socialist country?
I don't think there's a pure anything in history, as we heard a little while ago. There's no pure capitalist society.
Well, but maybe Pinochet's Chile came as close as possible.
Well, Pinochet tried to implement it as much as he could, with the Friedmanites and all those going down and creating a total market. I mean, after all, that's what they tried to do in Russia, right? The shock therapy right after the end of the Soviet Union didn't work out all that well. But I think the main point, as we've been hearing, is to try to figure out the balance, you know, and how you can, this is what socialists have been thinking for over 100 years, you know, how do you retain the benefits of a market economy and yet mitigate the negative features of a market economy? There's your problem, and no one has quite solved that, I think.
Well, we have to take a little break. We'll come back with more of this Please Explain look at socialism, with Eric Foner, the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, James Surowiecki, financial columnist for The New Yorker. Remember, our number here is 212-433-9692. And we are back with our guests looking at socialism for today's Please Explain. James Surowiecki, who's a financial columnist for The New York. Are you the financial columnist?
I'm the financial columnist. I'm not the only financial writer, but I am the one who writes the regular column. So,
Eric Foner, who's a DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, and your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's get right to some of those calls. Tom from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yeah. What do the more socialist states of Europe tell us in terms of how those policies, higher taxation, control of health care, what the impact would be on us in terms of employment, growth rates, fertility rates, all of these things? Well, I mean, what's the practical effect?
And I want to add to that the fact that Newt Gingrich and some other Republicans have recently been referring to European-style socialism as something that they feel the economic bailout is leading us to, and they're describing it as something, I guess, that we should be fearing.
I can just say a couple things about that. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that Europe, most of Europe, has really moved toward the center over the last 20 or 30 years. So it was once the case, I mean, in 1981, I believe, François Mitterrand of France actually nationalized most of the French banking sector, and that was a genuinely socialist act. He was really intending that the state would really be responsible for making many of those decisions, and quickly, well, not that quickly, but eventually kind of backed off from that. And you've seen, I mean, look at the British government, which, you know, no longer owns British Airways or British Rail, and you've seen a lot of divestment. So they have actually moved somewhat closer toward us. The other thing
I want to stop you for a second, because as somebody who has ridden the denationalized British Rails, I wonder whether that isn't an argument for socialism.
Oh, absolutely. What Thatcher and these guys did, and Blair, was, you know, to really, as you said, to dismantle. You know, they have pushed very much to the center, as we heard. The problem is the United States has kept moving to the right. So therefore, in terms of deregulation and just letting greed run amok, so, you know, the gap seems to still exist. But I think, you know, again, as we heard before, this is not socialist. This is not what Western Europe is not what socialists, strictly speaking, had really envisioned. These are capitalist societies with much broader social safety nets and social sense of responsibility than we have in the United States.
But doesn't a country like Norway have a nationalist?
If Newt Gingrich would like to compare the status of a person seeking health care in the United States or Western Europe, or you know, especially one without private health insurance in this country, or just look at the difference in life expectancy, which is considerably higher in Europe than it is here. The European situation has proven that these are very desirable features of a society, to have public programs that actually try to benefit all people rather than leaving it to the market, as we generally try to do in this country.
James, doesn't Norway have a nationalized oil industry?
Yeah, oil, when you have a country that has a huge amount of oil reserves, there's actually a kind of logic. You can almost argue that that's a natural monopoly. And from a market perspective, it's not obvious that just turning your natural resources over to one company or even two or three companies is necessarily beneficial. I think actually Scandinavia, I mean, if you think about the United States, I mean, isn't the U.S. government the biggest landowner in the United States? I think it still is.
Out in the West, yeah.
That doesn't really make us socialist exactly, I don't
think.
No. But say one thing about Scandinavia is very interesting, because one of the things you realize when you look at Europe as a whole is that actually the social arrangements that different countries have are quite distinct. And Scandinavia is especially interesting because in a number of Scandinavian countries, like Denmark and to some extent Sweden, there's actually a tremendous amount of room for the market in terms of the way capital is allocated. In Denmark, for instance, in terms of workers' rights, bosses are able to just fire workers at whenever they want, basically, like they can in the United States. But you have this tremendous social safety net. So as a result, it sort of essentially evens out the inequalities and power differentials that capitalism creates. And one of the open questions is whether that work can really only work in a kind of homogeneous, relatively small, coherent society like Scandinavia. But when you talk about kind of the European model, there are very different models depending on which country you're talking about, I think.
Didn't Sarah Palin boast of giving every Alaskan annual payments from taxes on oil companies?
Yeah.
Well, they're
like
Norway.
Was that a socialist arrangement?
If you have oil, you can do a lot with it until the price of oil collapsed. But I don't know that that made Palin a socialist, but certainly up in Alaska, they seem to benefit a lot from the accident of having all that oil.
I mean, Alaska is the closest thing in America to a kind of, you know, socialist third world state, basically, where almost all of the income actually comes from natural resources. It is literally the proceeds are literally distributed to citizens and the like. I mean, it unfortunately has also some of the unattractive aspects of it, like historically it's not been a very democratic state and has had enormous amount of cronyism and the rest. But I mean, that's, I think, just a function of the oil rather than anything else.
My guests are James Surowiecki, who's a financial columnist for The New Yorker, and will be leading a conversation on the economy at the New Yorker Summit on May 5th. Also with us is Eric Foner, the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Mary from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Lenny. As usual, a great show. I have a question That has to do with labeling and also turning the clock back, and that is a little history lesson from your guest. The right wing currently is a genius at using fear to label things and galvanize the public in their direction, and that includes the word socialism. Why in the world was National Socialism promulgated by the or promoted by the Nazis and Mussolini, and what's the fit with capitalism, with National Socialism or fascism?
Good question. I think the question illustrates that there is no particular, sort of political point on the spectrum from left to right that automatically goes with government control of the economy, because, as you said, the Nazis called themselves National Socialists, and yet they were entirely different in most of their policies than socialists, communists, et cetera, et cetera. So, I think it gets back to this question of how much of a controlling role the national government has in the direction of the economy. Now, Hitler, there's a lot of historical debate about this, but Hitler worked fairly comfortably with many of the big industrialists of Germany. One of the things we often hear, which I think is history does not bear out, is that, private enterprise is necessarily connected with democracy. There are many, many instances in history where private market capitalist enterprises have worked very comfortably with extremely authoritarian governments, whether it's in Nazi Germany or South Africa or China today or Chile under the dictatorship there, Pinochet. There's no necessary connection between capitalism and democracy, even though a lot of ideology seems to suggest that there is.
Although a lot more is made of the fact that there was no democracy under the socialist countries, the communist countries. Can we call the state capitalism of the Soviet Union socialist?
Yeah. How many hours do you want to debate that? There's a whole long literature on that. I mean, they called themselves socialist.
The USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
It was not. I don't think you should call it state capitalism under the Soviet Union. It became a kind of state capitalism under Putin. Under the Soviet Union, for better or worse, the government controlled the means of production. There were no private capitalists in that sense.
Can I just go back to the fascism question for a second, because I think it's actually interesting and gets at something that important that I wanted to touch on earlier, which is that the impulse to move beyond or away from capitalism actually can come from different points on the political spectrum. So traditional conservatives, not the sort of conservatives we have necessarily in the United States right now, but traditional conservatives, certainly if you go back to the 19th century, disliked capitalism quite a bit, because capitalism, one of the reasons Marx, we can say he liked it, but one of the reasons he praised it was for its dynamism, for its ability to kind of erase traditional social relations, for its ability to kind of reinvent the world. Well, if you're a genuine conservative, that's not a plus, that's a minus. And so, you definitely have had kind of corporatist, or to some extent, I think you could view some of the fascist impulses based on this, a desire to kind of bring it under control, not in the same way or with the same ethical goals as traditional socialism has had, but in a certain kind of anti-capitalism. The other thing I would say, and I think this is very important for thinking about the United States, is that there is another, you could argue that there's another tradition, another kind of ethical opposition to capitalism tradition, which is the kind of Christian or Catholic opposition to capitalism, which is not really socialist in some respects. It gets kind of complicated, but certainly insists on the need for, some measure of equality, for a significant safety net, and does not view the unrestrained workings of the market as a good thing. I mean, if you go back to 1881, the Pope issued an encyclical, I think it's called Rerum Novarum, and you read that, and that really is laying out in some ways a kind of what you might call social democratic, although now I guess in Europe you'd call it Christian democratic ideal. And so there are these different strains which are sort of similar in their opposition to capitalism, maybe not similar in the ultimate view of what the role of the state should be.
Like liberation theology, although the Catholic Church now is kind of distancing itself from
the
people.
Yeah, I mean, liberation theology, I think, is closer to a genuine socialism in the sense of really wanting the state to be to essentially control more of the means of production. But I think you're right. I mean, I think that's where one of those strands.
There were a lot of Christian socialists, literally. They called themselves right. that in the late 19th, early 20th century.
And there was Dorothy Day, right here in New York.
Yes, a Catholic kind of socialism. Most of the Christian socialists in the United States were more Protestant than came out
right.
of the old, almost the abolitionist tradition, the sort of religious perfectionist tradition. But I think that was a very good point. And yes, they're also, I mean, in Britain, there's a tradition of what they call Tory socialism for the reasons we just heard. And in fact, today, oddly enough, the Conservative Party in Britain under Cameron has been defending some of the social welfare policies which the Blair-Brown administration has been trying to dismantle. And so the Cameron is speaking the language of social solidarity and community and the market undermining those things, whereas the Labour Party, which originally 100 years ago was a socialist party, is very much now the spokesman of, you know, the free market and that kind of thing. So politics makes strange bedfellows.
Sometimes. Nick from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Over the years, I had familiarized myself with works of Marx, Engels, and Lenin and found it actually very entertaining. But one question always bothered me. Basically, when it comes to socialism, it seemed like socialism that leading to communism, in a sense, it's the end of the society. It basically stops the development of economical, cultural development of human beings as we know it. And literally, if I can't, working hard and making to make better living for myself, then what is the point to bother?
This is the argument that socialism undermines private enterprise and entrepreneurship, the desire to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. Gentlemen?
I mean, I think there's no question that I mean, in my view, there's a famous line about socialism in the United States. There's the problem of why there's been no really powerful socialist tradition in the U.S. I mean, as Professor Froner said, there at the beginning of the 20th century there was a very strong socialist party, but ultimately it was a minority party. And so there's this famous essay in 1906, why is there no socialism in the United States? And the famous one of the answers the author offered was that socialist utopias always die on the reefs of roast beef and apple pie, in the U.S. at least. And I think the flip side of that is that I do think that one of the problems that socialist economies have had is a lack of innovation, a lack of ability to consistently generate new economic growth. And I think there probably is some way in which part of the reason for that, I think there are two major reasons for it. One is it's much harder to manage an economy well if you have to do it, if a small group of people have to do it, because economies are enormously complex. One of the geniuses of the market happens to be as an information processing a capital allocating system. It happens kind of, in effect, kind of automatically, and that's very hard to do for the economic planners at the and it doesn't matter whether it's Ben Bernanke or anybody. It's just hard to do. The other thing I think is that there probably is something to the idea that it's hard to consistently generate new innovation if you're not in some way tapping people's, I guess I'll just call it greed, that greed actually is a very powerful, or desire for more, is a very powerful impulse in terms of creating economic growth.
Now, we have about a minute to go, and I do want to ask Eric Foner, so with all of this, do you think that the critics are right that Barack Obama's bailout plan is socialist?
Unfortunately not. In other words, whether it's socialist or not, I think it ought to be a lot more radical than it actually is. But I think the main, there's no question that what was just said is correct in terms of the history of economies. The problem is, Adam Smith put this forth over two centuries ago, that the market is the most effective way of allocating resources. But Adam Smith also was a great critic of the consequences of the market for human existence. You know,
right.
Is this the society we want to live in, where human beings are considered purely as factors of production, where self-interest is the ruling, you know, the ruling principle for everything that happens in the society? In other words, you might say, are we an economy or are we a society? Capitalism
right.
is very good at on the economy side, but in terms of a society where there is some notion of a collective good, capitalism doesn't do very well on that.
And we have to leave it there. And I thank you so much for being with us today on Please Explain, talking about socialism. I've been talking with Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, and with James Surowiecki, a financial columnist for The New Yorker. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having us on.
Nice to talk to you. Yeah.